We've lost that Christian concept of what authentic freedom actually is. And authentic freedom in Christianity is not the freedom to do whatever you want. It is the freedom to do what is good, what is true, and what is beautiful. And as you submit yourself more to what is good and true, the more freedom you discover. It's a paradox. Jesus says, if you want to find your life, you've got to lose it.
You're listening
to the Thinking Matters podcast.
Conversations
at the intersection of
faith,
culture,
and reason.
I'm your host, Todd Funk, and today I'm excited to be joined by my friend, Brendan Malone. Good to have you on the show today.
Todd, it's great to be back. We were just saying before we started, it's been a minute since we've seen each other in person, but I suppose virtual will do instead.
Yeah, for now, I guess.
Yeah.
For those of you that aren't familiar with Brendan, I'll you know, explain a little bit about him. He's a husband and father of five, correct, Brendan?
That's five kids? Last time I checked.
Or as of this morning, right?
Yeah, as of this morning.
Yeah. Brendan's the founder of one of the founders of Activate Pro-Life Training Week, and he's been kind of a presenter and keynote for that organization since it began. He's also the founder and director of LifeNet, and LifeNet offers educational seminars and trainings in bioethics, sexual ethics and issues, cultural trends, which equip the culture to live counterculturally, the young people and the old people to live counterculturally, build a better society. He's been equipping audiences in churches and schools and other events for more than 20 years. And he believes that the Christian tradition offers an enduring and dependable guide to discerning goodness, truth, and beauty. And it's a call to give to love, give self-sacrificial love in authentic community and human flourishing. That was off your website, so I'm kind of reading there. But does that pretty much summarize what you do and what you're doing at Brendan?
Yeah, in a nutshell, you could say that we're about planting and nurturing the seeds of leadership, virtue, ethical concern through the promotion of Christian goodness, truth, and beauty, you know?
I love it. Today we're going to talk about something I had not talked about before with anybody. It's the death of the West. But before we get into any of that, Brendan, I want to ask you, tell us a little bit about your spiritual journey. How did you come to Christ?
Well, for me, it's interesting. I grew up in a Christian home, charismatic Catholic parents. Uh-huh. And it was just, there was always that ever-present reality of Christ. In my particular faith tradition, the baptism of infants, I know it's a hot debate at the moment about Christian apologetics, both Protestant and Catholic, actually, but the baptism of infants is sort of standard. So there's a great gift that I was really born into in a sense, and I'm grateful for that. My parents gave me something. And then as I grew in years, I had to embrace it myself, you know, and begin to that journey into adulthood where you say, well, am I really going to follow this gift, this sort of path that my parents have helped me on? It was an ever-present reality. God was always at work, and there were so many ways I look back on now, and I see His hand in my life at work. And even through my teenage years, I had my rebellions, but they were not as bad as they could have been. That's for sure. Yeah. And I'm grateful for that. You know, some people have these sort of phenomenal testimonies of darkness to light, and these moments of profound growth.
Drug addiction. And all that stuff.
No, not me. You know, I'm grateful to have been spared a lot of that. I made some foolish mistakes in some areas of my life, in my early 20s.
Yeah.
I would say God's hand was always there, and that's been the story of my life. Really, God has graced me in ways I do not deserve, and obviously, as you can imagine, you know, as all Christians would say, we can never ever even hope to repay Him for. So that's been my journey, really.
Awesome, and we hope that and pray for that for your children as well. Huh?
Amen to that.
Yeah. Well, outside of kind of ministry and podcasting and speaking, what do you enjoy doing that helps you relax and kind of recharge? Do you have any like hobbies that you enjoy?
Well, that's a great question. This year has been particularly busy for me. On the ministry front, I'm often traveling. I mean, a lot around New Zealand and also in Australia now regularly. And this year in particular, Australia's just back full time again, and so that it's been pretty full on. And I've actually been thinking about that lately. You know, I've got to recover some of my hobbies. Like
absolutely,
I used to enjoy a bit of hunting, it's been a while since I've got out for a walk with the sticks that go bang. So it's I try and get into the gym most days just to clear the head and keep my fitness up. I like to read. Reading's really important for me. I mean, I'm a bit of an amateur cinephile as well, actually. I enjoy good cinema because I think it speaks to the heart of the human condition when it's done well. So, as I said, it's been for me that the last couple of years, particularly like LifeNet, I've been in full-time ministry for 21 years now. And LifeNet was the organization I founded, about 5 years ago. And so it's been quite a busy five-year period where just establishing and building and working on the ministry as such has sort of meant that I haven't quite had as much spare time as I would have liked. So it's one of my goals for next year is to start, rebalancing, shall we say.
Yeah, very good. Very good. I'm sure your wife will appreciate you'll be a happier version of you.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Are any of your kids old enough to hunt with you yet?
Yeah, they are really. My son Nathaniel in particular, he's really coming into his own there, and he's quite interested in that. So you get to that stage where you think, I've got to be present in a different kind of way for my kids. You know, as they get older, that sort of substantial presence. It's not that I'm not present, but the way in which you're present when they're younger, it's a bit different. There's a bit more of an intellectual engagement, I think, that's required. As they go through their teenage years, you know?
No, absolutely. What do you hunt? My dad, he bought me a shotgun when I was about, 12 or 13. We'd go on the high desert and hunt rabbit and quail and stuff. And what do you hunt down? You're in the South Island.
It's a combination of things. So deer is a big thing here. You can hunt tar. I haven't done that yet, but deer stalking is a thing here. And of course there's rabbits and hares, which are just great fun, really. And we're pretty blessed too that we have in our church, we've got access to a couple who own a farm strip probably 30 minutes down the road, which actually it's a perfect range just for plinking targets. It's got an embankment behind it and everything. So,
nice.
You know, you could just take the kids out there and have a plink, and it's, you know, all of that. We're pretty blessed where we are, really.
Yeah, that's really cool. Well, let's jump into it. We said we'd discuss the collapse of the West. And what objective did you have in mind? Was it the kind of the moral decline or the institutional decay or loss of faith or demographic, economic collapse or all the above or none of the above?
Well, I'd say it's all of the above, Todd. It stems from a spiritual collapse, though. That's the fundamental thing that's happened. There's been a major spiritual collapse. I think big fundamental part of that is we have lost sight of a good metaphysics and anthropology. So metaphysics, what is reality? Mm-hmm. We've created alternate realities built on all these various ideologies. Mm-hmm. And then we've also got a loss of authentic anthropology. So what does it mean to be human? And, and really that's no surprise because our vision and our understanding of what it is to be human comes directly from that Christian concept of being made in the image of God, the Imago Dei. And so if we understand who God is, we know who we are and how we find our flourishing. Lose sight of that and you start to lose sight of who you are. And so, in many ways, I'd say we're probably in a worse predicament than the pre-Christian pagan cultures because we have this weird hybrid of paganism and technology and ideology and there's no clear sense of virtue. Like at least the pagans had a sense that you're supposed to be religious in some way. At least they had a sense that you're supposed to live virtue. We've lost a lot of that. And so it's carnage is how it best describe it, really.
Well, how would you, in leading up to this talk, I thought, is it real or is it imagined? I mean, it seems like in every generation, there are those that are saying that this is the worst of time that there's ever been. And, they think of the good old days with nostalgia, but you think that we are genuinely in the deep end of it, huh?
Well, there's two aspects. I think you're right. There is I think every generation thinks theirs is the last in some way or other.
And the worst, and theirs are the worst that they've ever been. Couldn't get any worse.
And I think in some areas they are the worst. In other areas, no, things could get a lot worse. So, I'm a bit more, I guess circumspect about that. I think the reality is, though, that we are in a state of culture. I mean, I look at it this way. There's really two options on the table if you're a Christian. One is that this current cultural collapse that we are undergoing will result in the birth of something new from the ashes. You know, God has more of a plan for humanity, or it's the end of all things and Christ will return at some point. So I'm not picking a lane there. That's in God's hands. It's well above my pay grade. And so it's not a matter of saying, oh, well, this is the end of all things in that sense. But what we're really going through is the liberal order that we've lived under for several hundred years since the Enlightenment period, it's collapsing because its anthropology, its view of the human person was flawed. Its metaphysics was flawed. And what we tried to do is we tried to build a Western culture where we could keep all of the good fruits of Christianity, but we wouldn't have any of the religious elements, basically. So you tried to build, for the first time ever in human history, no other society has ever done this. We tried to build a society without reference to anything sacred or religious at the center of it. You know, you just make up your own mind, Todd. You're an individual. I'm an individual. I make up my own mind. And we'll all just be happy together. Well, what we're discovering now is that you can't do that. Societies don't last. And it took a few hundred years because the last remnants of Christianity slowly faded.
Yeah.
And then you get to a situation where no one knows where to get the good fruit from. And so this is a unique thing in human history.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even secular writers like Tom Holland have pointed out that we're swimming in the sea of Christianity while pointing our finger and judging it and trying to, you know, jettison that Christianity. I don't know. I mean, what are the chances of the West surviving without, you know, being cut off from the head, cut off from the roots, if you will, of, you know, Christ?
Well, it can't really. And it's a funny thing, like what you're just saying there. I was thinking about this recently, actually. You know, people a couple of years ago were saying we're living in a post-Christian society. And I understand what they're saying. In some ways, that's kind of true. But in other ways, that's not really true at all. Like Tom Holland is right that you can't – the West is inextricably linked to Christianity. So, you know, you can't, if we were living in a post-Christian society, we'd be in real trouble. We're already in a bad spot, but it would be really, really bad. So we still have our view of the world, even if you are a agnostic or an atheist, even if you're militantly anti-Christian in the current West, the way you think about the human person is still given to you by the Christian
Church. I think even people like Dawkins are coming to that realization, aren't they? Like, well, what have we done? You know, Nietzsche, what have we done if we've killed God?
That's exactly the absolute
collapse.
And that's the thing. Like you mentioned Nietzsche. Like Nietzsche is someone who I find myself regularly talking about with audiences because Friedrich Nietzsche, I think, in many ways, is he is like if you said to me, well, who's the most responsible for shaping modern Western ideological culture in the secular sense? You know, your typical secular mind. I would say it doesn't really work that way. There's a whole combination of thinkers and factors. But if you put a gun to my head and really force me, I'd say, well, Nietzsche, we're really living in the age of Nietzsche. He's been so influential. And the thing about Nietzsche was the influence of his destructive aspects of his ideology. But, you know, God is dead and we have killed them. And he thinks that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But then also, he's also a prophet in one sense because he's smart enough to realize, well, the West was built on Christianity. So if God is dead, where are we going to get our morals from now? And he was a lot more astute about that fact than others who followed after him have been.
Yeah. I mean, what if you got a secular thinker on your show and they wanted to argue that kind of our Western civilization was kind of inevitable, that we were going to evolve that ethic out of the Enlightenment era and whatnot? I mean, couldn't empathy and social contract theory, work for people that don't believe in God?
Well, I'd say no. Like social contract theory, what it does is it destroys community. It now treats us like individuals, which we're actually not. We are individual beings, but we are communal in nature. And liberalism failed to recognize that. And it also failed to recognize that there's lots of traditions that we don't consent to that are actually we're born into and are important. So the liberal idea is you're supposed to choose all that stuff for yourself. You're supposed to be a blank slate. And if you want it, you want it. If you don't, you don't. And we'll all just get along. But it's clear now, like, think about your own life. And there is so much in your life which your parents gave to you without your consent and often before you could even really understand or reason about it. And without that sort of stuff, like virtue, training and virtue, you would not be a good responsible citizen. We don't have a society. So tradition is important. Community is essential to us. And social contract theory just breaks all of that. And it says, well, you're an individual contracting in via the government, really. The state becomes the intermediary. And really what they've done is they've bestowed powers upon secular government. They took them off the church, really, and bestowed them upon secular government. And then they thought that this would somehow work. And it, among other things, there's lots of other anthropological challenges for liberalism as well. But it, as I said, it's quite clear. Like, and we've got a very clear example of this. We can compare notes, if you like. As we've seen, particular Islamic culture and also other, I think probably Indian culture coming into Western nations as well, they hold on to their sort of sacred tradition. And they remain strong and united. Whereas the Western culture is just sort of collapsing and doesn't really have an answer. It doesn't even know what to do sometimes in the face of, say, some of the Islamic extremism, because we've tried to build a society without a reference to a sacred compass point, you know?
Yeah, we have no North Star there. Yeah.
No.
I mean, do you think that the whole debate on gender identity and AI and transhumanism, you think that is driving this death of the West, or just a reflection of it?
I think it's probably both ends. So there are aspects of things which, like when I think about AI, really, I'm preparing a series of lectures for an event I'm speaking at in January on this very topic, AI and dignity.
Huh?
Really is like, I'd describe as the ultimate form of digital narcissism. Really, the machine is just talking back to you and telling you what you want to hear, ultimately.
Spitting back what you,
But it's, in many ways, it's also typical of a decline and what we're facing. Like, there's so many people who don't understand that AI is not a person. It's not nothing like a person. It is not self-aware. But because our metaphysics has collapsed, people see some mimicry and they're just not wise enough to recognize that, oh, this is not self-aware. This is not sentient. It's not like a person at all.
Yeah.
And so in some ways is a sort of a fruit of the decline. But that whole concept of technology goes back even further. Someone like Francis Bacon and his idea that, you know, as our knowledge of the natural world grew and our scientific prowess grew, we would free ourselves. He talked about knowledge as power. You know, we'd free ourselves from the restraints of nature. And what that does is sets up a relationship between humanity and the natural world where nature is basically our enslaver. And so we've got to unshackle ourselves. And then all of a sudden technology becomes this great important source of freedom. And the question is, well, what's going to limit the use of technology? And so you see there's a manifestation that by the time we get to AI, it's sort of almost out of control. The Tower of Babel is really, you know, flying now.
Yeah.
But then also the flip side is that the more we get immersed in it, the more potential for destruction you actually end up with. So it's sort of like a both and type thing. And I think something like gender ideology is a reflection of a culture where we don't know our true identity, and you lose touch with truth itself. It becomes relativized. The individual subject makes it up for themselves. Nietzsche, again, who's all about self-creation. Well, I'll self-create my own body in my own image. It's all manifesting, and then it becomes a sort of spiral where it reverses back in on itself and starts to become destructive for the West as well.
Yeah. Do you think that the fire for that started in the United States and my country? I mean, it seemed to popularize it. It seemed to just everybody identifying as something that they're not, just got really big there.
Well, you're not wrong. I think in a sense, this is where we, I think, perhaps don't appreciate. This is something I'm really interested in, is the way culture works. And what we're probably not appreciating is that I think maybe we're starting to a bit more now, that America has been so pivotal in Western thought in recent years, really since the end of World War II. Mm. Prior to World War II, it's very different. And you know yourself, like even in the lead up to World War II, there was a very strong anti-interventionist stance in America. The understanding was, well, no, we don't involve ourselves in foreign wars. Yeah. My kids, all they've known of America is foreign wars. You know, like so ever since World War II, where America, through no fault of their own, really, they were the biggest power. They got involved in World War II. We had to defeat Hitler, but then they become, because everyone else is basically, the British Empire has ruined itself economically on the back of two wars. And then everything else is being rebuilt. And so America is the strong protectorate, the strong power. And it becomes like the guiding light, the world police, basically. And so American culture becomes quite pivotal around the world. And so it starts to shape a lot of what happens around the world. And that liberal order, too, is, you know, very strong in that regard. And so I think when you think about gender ideology, I'm firmly in the camp with those commentators who would say that once you had the Obergefell decision, the Supreme Court mm-hmm. legalizing gay marriage,
mm-hmm.
that was the point at which America declared effectively to the whole world that gender is really kind of irrelevant. Because if it doesn't matter in marriage, the gender of the two spouses don't matter, then why would it matter really anywhere else? And I think a lot of people point to that moment as being quite pivotal, and I think that's true. And then I think it just spread out. But in saying that, the UK had its own, you know, activists doing their own thing as well. But I think once America went down that rabbit hole, I think it was inevitable that most of the West was going to be dragged along with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you see glimmers of hope? You talked about the two options, either Jesus is coming back or there's going to be a great revival type of thing. Do you see glimmers of hope for the latter, that there will be a revival, that this is just God's wake-up call, that God's pruning us, pruning the church?
Well, I'm a firm believer. J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of The Lord of the Rings, who is a really faithful Christian Catholic man, and someone wrote to him in a letter once and said, you know, what do you think about the end of the world? Because obviously it's a big theme that underpins a lot of his work in The Lord of the Rings, is this, yeah. you know, collapse of Middle Earth and the saving of the world. And his reply was fascinating. He said, look, I am a Catholic and I'm a Christian, I'm a Catholic, so I believe that basically there's like we're in a long defeat, in a sense, until the final victory that comes. But in that, it's not a hopeless defeat either. Christian hope is always ever present. But I think there is something interesting going on culturally right now. There is a type of quiet revival. I think what we've tended to think as Christians is you have a revival moment when God bestows some special anointing upon a preacher or a person, a great saint in the life of the church who's going to do something that sparks, you know, massive communal revival, a restoration of a return to Christ and to faith amongst large numbers of people. What we're seeing now is something a little bit different. We're seeing a lot of particularly young men who are coming back to the faith of their own volition or discovering it. They're looking around the world. I'm hearing this story over and over again. I was just at an event speaking in a church just a couple of weeks ago in the South Island, and I had two men in their 30s. This was their story. They were coming into Christianity. They're on the journey in. And they'd looked around the culture and they'd seen this great evil, and that had sort of shocked them and frightened them a bit. And the collapse, they'd looked into the abyss, if you like, and they thought there must be light somewhere. And so they went looking. And they said, well, Christianity clearly is that light. I was talking to a minister recently about this. It's really, as we've spent probably decades now trying to create the perfect program for evangelization, and God's reminding us, well, hey, buddy, it's all about my grace. It always has been. And I'm going to work in the culture even without you. When you're trying to figure out the program, I'm out here, you know, bringing people back. And so there's something like that. There is something interesting going on there in that regard. You know, where that'll land fully, I mean, who knows? But as for me, I always have hope too. Like, even in the midst of collapse, as we know as Christians from the cross, what seems like absolute total defeat is absolutely not total defeat.
Yeah, God's the master of the, well, you talked about cinematography. God's the master of the Hitchcock twist at the end, isn't
right,
he?
Right, he wrote the best one.
Yeah, for absolute sure. Well, what about the Western universities? What part are they playing now? I mean, with their, they seem to prize ideology much more than truth. Do you think that's going to swing back? You think that's had its heyday? You think those are in decline? People are like getting tired of it. The sponsors, even, you know,
it's hard to know. Look, here's the thing about the universities. That's a great example of institutional capture that people talk about. You know, once great institutions, again, that came directly out of Christianity, that were captured by ideology. There are still good people and good, you know, course programs that work around the world in different universities, but they tend to be the exemption that proves the rule. And the question is that they, like, at the moment, certainly they don't seem to be relinquishing their power. They seem to be, and it almost like they've reconsolidated themselves a bit, as culturally they've taken a bit of a battering in recent years. Mm-hmm. They've started to sort of retreat back into the university and really, you're doubling down, holding the line there. So it's hard to know what will happen there. I think one thing I do know is that the idea of a pendulum swing, I think, is actually a bit flawed. So I used to think this way myself. I used to think, well, things get really bad and then they swing back. But that assumes that there is almost like basically a guarantee and that history is like guaranteed to stay on track. But that's actually not the story at all.
No.
And you can look at once great cultures and you can see that in actual fact, sometimes the pendulum swung right off the edge of the cliff and they didn't come back. So there's, you know, what I think we'll see more of though is, we're starting to see this a bit more in New Zealand, but overseas, I think it's a bit more obvious. There's a revival in what we call classical education. And that is that very much is, again, in the Christian mold, the whole person being formed, not just being taught technical knowledge, but being formed, and it's very much grounded in the classics. And so you get a lot of focus on virtue and history.
Are we seeing that in, I mean, I've know of, you know, some co-op groups and homeschool groups, even in South Auckland, that are doing that kind of thing. Is that where we're only finding it now, or are there bona fide, at least Christian schools that are whole hog into that?
No, so what we are seeing is definitely, so homeschoolers, you're right, have held the line, but now what we're starting to see, like in New Zealand, we've got at least one classical education school that was started as a charter school up in Auckland, and they're growing. So they start with a younger group, and as they get older, they add more year level.
Yeah.
And there's another school that's just been started in Auckland called Totara Point, which is not, wouldn't identify as classical education, but it's very much in that similar mold. Overseas, though, it's a lot more pronounced. My younger brother, him and his wife and their kids, he married a Canadian, so they live in Canada, and he teaches history in one of the Augustinian academies. It's a classical, it's a group of classical education schools that, you know, Christian, and he's over there teaching history, and they're very much in the, I was talking to him, he was over recently in New Zealand, and he said, you know, I've been teaching Homer's Odyssey to my kids, and then he said, I'm going to have to teach them Dante next year, so I'm going to have to go and read it myself. And so there's a, they're really getting steeped in this great depth of what, you know, Christianity built and gifted to the West, and it took prior traditions too. There's a beautiful grace, I think, in history that and some theologians and some Christian thinkers talk about this, that that just a couple of hundred years before Christ is incarnated and arrives amongst us in human form and Christianity is born, the Greek culture is really at its pinnacle with natural human reason. And these thinkers would say that basically God timed this perfectly so that when Christianity arises, it can take that, the best of Christian natural human thought, and elevate it right into its fullness through Christ. And I think there's something in that. So classical education is about recovering that full tradition.
You
know, and that's the only way to combat cultural crisis.
Well, so, I mean, do you see, like, if the West is indeed collapsing, I mean, what do we do? Do we retreat and build like parallel structures, or do we try and re-engage culture and you know, as some would say, let's take over the media and educational realms and, you know, the political realms? What do you find yourself with that?
I think it's both, and I think I'm always very wary when someone says, well, this is the only strategy. I'm like, okay, sometimes that can be true, but I think it's a very narrow bandwidth for that. I think it's often both and. So I think there are times, and it's all about context, there are times when you'd say, okay, if an opportunity presents to actually get invested in and take back, you know, institutions from the ideological capture, yeah, we should actively act. At other times, it's a bit more of a quagmire. And so it's not so much retreat as it is, I think, solidifying and really nurturing. Like Vaclav Bender is someone who I'm greatly inspired by. He was a Christian man who lived under Czechoslovakian Soviet communism. And so it was just awful anti-Christian hostility. He's a Catholic man. He had five kids. He was a thinker. He was part of a group that in fact, he wrote an essay called The Parallel Polis. So when your main polis, the main life of your society is in a state of destruction and ideology and lies, what you do is you actually build your own authentic culture within it, in a sense, and live it quietly underneath it. And they did exactly that. And then when Soviet communism finally collapsed, and, you know, it all collapsed in Czechoslovakia, they were one of the first to actually transition into a more open, free form of government, because they'd already built this parallel polis. They were living it. And one of that group, actually, a guy called Vaclav Havel, who's a bit more well-known, he became the first president after that. And so they focused on education and arts, and obviously fundamental to that is Christian faith and tradition and history, and they celebrate, they nurture, they safeguard all of that stuff. And I think that's what Christianity should be about. It should never be seen as a negative reaction. It should always be seen as we have our own culture of goodness, yeah. truth, and beauty. And like Christ says, yeah, you cast the demon, the evil, out of the house, but then you've got to fill your house with something else. Otherwise, when seven more demons come along, they find an empty house and take over. So what's yeah. that other thing we're filling our house, our culture, our communities with?
Right. Well, how do we, I mean, some respond to moral decay with, especially in the States, with Christian nationalism. I mean, is that a legitimate, you know, defense of heritage or a dangerous confusion of gospel and nation? What do you think
well,
about that?
Well, yeah, that's a great debate. I personally think, looking at that whole question, that I think, first of all, nationalism, the idea of nationalism now gets a bit of an unfair bad rap because people, they think Nazism. That's what most people are thinking. They think the worst excesses, like they think some sort of fascistic or Naziistic or socialist nationalism. But that's not necessarily what, like a genuine healthy pride in nation is not a bad thing at all. And liberalism makes us very, I think, overly suspicious of any of that kind of stuff. That's one of the problems of Enlightenment liberalism. It just makes us overly suspicious of tradition, of community, of, you know, any, and that means the community of a nation as well. And the whole liberal order has built a world where we're supposed to pretend that, you know, nationhood, you know, and identity doesn't really matter. We're all just sort of interchangeable units. You could take a human from Mumbai, put them in New York, take a New Yorker and put them in Mumbai, and there's no difference. Well, clearly it's not true, you know?
No.
And so there are differences that they matter. Sometimes they're beautiful. Sometimes there are challenges to be addressed. But the point is that the response to what's going on, I think Christian nationalism is a phrase that I think is fraught in the sense that depends on who you're talking to. I've heard healthy definitions of that and then very unhealthy ones. And then people who are overly wrongly suspicious of it and people who are just too embedded in a nationalism that's not good. So I think there's a conversation there, though, that needs to happen around, what is the place of, like in New Zealand, my nation, you know, maybe, I don't know whether you sit in the American nation more or the Kiwi more, whatever.
Like one foot in each.
Yeah, a foot in each. what does it mean to be in a nation and to have pride and to be part of that? And we've got there's a restoration in a sense and a conversation that needs to happen around all of that. Because one thing that is clear is, okay, so I think people's biggest fear when they hear Christian nationalism is they probably think theocracy, some sort of religious tyrant or dictator is going to rule us.
Yeah, there's in the States, I just read about the no king marches and stuff. You know, Trump is calling himself the king and we don't have a king here.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is too, I mean, you already have a no king's day. That's July the 4th. That's the whole thing right in the UK. It's Independence Day. What's happening, I think, is people are realizing, okay, Enlightenment liberalism did sell us down the river a lot. And so there is a recovery of Christianity in the public life of our nation, our Western nations. We need to recover. You don't need to have a theocracy, though, to recover that. It is just a recognition, I think. There's a lot of more of a conversation to be had here, and I don't pretend to have all the answers. It's a very fraught, and it's going to be challenging. But the truth is we need to recover Christianity as pride of place in the West. And that means it needs to be given, even by non-Christians, a difference. We need to recognize that is our tradition. It should be given special privileges, I think, in our society that other groups don't have. We don't ever mistreat them, but it's that we're not all equal in a sense because Christianity really did build the West and it is the vision of reality that is, you know, it is goodness, truth, and beauty. It is the truest, the fullness of truth. And so to say, it doesn't matter, or you can build a nation and treat it as if it's just optional, you know, but then there's this fraught conversation, like you say, of avoiding the pitfalls of establishing like theocracy, where the church all of a sudden, Pastor Bob is now ruling, you know, your local town council. That's not the vision either. So, yeah.
Right. It just staggers the imagination that some can't project down the line where our current trajectory is taking us.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't take much imagination at all. Maybe they'd call us paranoid or delusional, part of it in some instances, you know, this has been tried in the courts of history, hasn't it? Some of the ideologies out there.
Yeah. Well, and you see the worst of it really, ironically, around the time of the Enlightenment, is that the French Revolution is very, you know, quickly follows on with the Reign of Terror. And it's built on the back of these Enlightenment ideas. and this, you know, this extreme violence that became so destructive that even the originators of the Reign of Terror are killed on their own guillotines. And it's just the final most brutal act, which really brings it to an end, actually, is the execution of a large group of Christian nuns, Catholic Carmelite nuns, these beautiful women of prayer. They're brought out in a cart and they're guillotined. Like, and apparently it's just, it was such a shocking thing to witness in French culture that it sort of, it shocked people out of their complacency. But what happens is that you can see now what's going on is, in light of particularly what's happening in America, I see constantly people talking about, you know, we need to recover decency in the public square and we need to recover, you know, charitable dollar. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. But you know where that comes from? It comes from Christianity, and you can't cover it without the Christian part, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's the current experiment. Like you say, people wanting Christianity without Christ.
Yeah. And that's the liberal flaw. The liberalism thought it could keep all the good fruit from the tree of Christianity and it wouldn't need the tree. Mm. And initially it just left the tree alone, if you like. It just carried on in parallel. And a lot of these men, really, even the Enlightenment liberal thinkers, they kind of lived cultural Christianity anyway. And so their ideology is taking place, that they are reaping the privilege and the benefit of a Christian culture while they're doing their liberal thing. But then as that begins to collapse, increasingly liberalism then turns on the tree of Christianity and starts taking an axe to it more and more. And again, you can survive until you cut through the taproot. And then once the tree's gone, where do you get that good fruit from? And liberalism can't give you the answer.
Yeah, it turns on it. Yeah. It's like I did a talk once. And I don't remember what I think I was talking about, social justice and how taken to its extreme, those social justice warriors, it turns on itself. There's always an oppressed and an oppressor. Yeah. And, you know, it's got to turn on itself.
Well, we're seeing that right now. Funnily enough, there's a very practical example of this. Right now, there are a group of lesbians in New Zealand who are taking they're taking a court action of some kind against the Auckland Pride organization, because the Auckland Pride didn't want a group of lesbian women who were promoting womanhood, you know, and the sort of the things turning in on itself in this destructive cycle. And I mean, I think ultimately also there's no, without a footing, without a compass bearing, what you start to see very troublingly is, again, going back to Nietzsche, that execution of raw power, the Übermensch, the overman, the strong man or woman who will take power and will rebuild society in their own image. And so, yeah, you're right. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to see where things are going, but what you do have to be is grounded in reality and sound metaphysics and in the truth. And that's when you're a Christian, we're in relationship with the truth itself. Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. And so for Christianity, truth is a person. It is the person of Christ, and truth is prized above all else. You know, it's prioritized. And so for Christians, you know, we're not rocket scientists, but you can see because your bearings are correct. You know, you're not floundering around in the dark. You're a bit more prophetic in a sense. You can understand the pitfalls and the dangers that lie ahead.
Yeah, that's good stuff. So, I mean, one of the things that I've read that you've said that before the, you know, modern West wants to keep Christian ethics, like human rights, but ditch the theology. I want to get back to that because some of the secular thinkers still are thinking we can determine what's right. It's, you know, on consensus basis or whatever. Mm. I mean, do you think that history has enough examples of where that goes wrong to point us to that, or people are still trying to do that or thinking we can get it right?
Yeah, I think there are more recent historical examples because, as I said, traditionally you've never had a culture before that's tried to build itself. Like the word culture comes from the word cult, which we think of today in negative connotations, but and literally that's the root of religion and religious cult. It's not a bad thing initially. So we think of a cult as a bad thing, but cult and culture are intertwined. And so what religious tradition gives you is your moral boundaries and the prohibitions. And though that gives rise to your culture, Philip Reeve, who was not a Christian himself, a great academic, but not a Christian. And he said, very simple, but true observation, profound observation. He says, basically, without moral prohibitions, you don't have any boundaries, and you can't have a culture. And you've got to get those moral boundaries from a transcendent religious source. And he actually said the Ten Commandments in Christianity is the best source. And he's not a Christian. He's an atheist saying this. But it's true. And so in place of that, when you don't have that, like, this is a grand experiment in a sense. We are now living out the worst excesses of at the moment, or out, not probably the worst of the worst, but very bad. Like abortion, for example. You talked about demography and demographics earlier on. We have not had enough kids, and the world is about to go into a major crisis of population decline.
Yeah.
People, I don't think, are aware of just the implications of what that means. We haven't had enough kids. We've aborted far too many of the kids that we did have. And like right now around the globe, the top 10 causes of death, plus they're not in the top 10. The top 10 are all disease related, but we'll add homicide and suicide as well. Those 12 causes every day claim approximately 95,000 lives. Every day, there are 200,000 abortions around the globe that happen. Like there is a death toll and a level of violence that we've actually perpetrated against ourselves.
Is that lopsided towards the West, or is that just globally?
That is globally, but you can see in the West how that, what would you call it, that almost suicidal ideation, it's literally manifested now in legislation, extreme abortion laws and euthanasia. And that's just the peak of it. And so where was I going with this? What was your, remind me the original question again. I've now gone around in circles. This is typical now.
Well, ditching the theology behind the West, and what happens when you sever the root we're talking about. I don't know.
Yeah,
there was a book, wasn't there, called The Death of the West, and it was talking about a population death and the dearth that you're talking about, death of a culture, just because. I mean, I've got my own, one of my daughters living in Melbourne decided, oh, we're not going to have kids, and, you're wondering, what's that going to lead to? Because you're right, most people don't think of the ramifications of just a population dearth in different countries, and they wonder why there's just sometimes the idea of, well, we've got to just get more immigrants, more immigrants, more immigrants. Well, that's not going to solve your problem, especially if they're unskilled, and they're going to
Well, also, most nations now are, apart from sub-Saharan Africa, they are in population decline as well. So where are you getting the immigrants from? At the moment, you can find them, but just a couple of decades, they're not going to be available either. And what you will see is there's definite economic impacts that people haven't really considered, because currently, this is why, for example, our retirement age has to be increased, because we can't afford to keep it at 65, because there's not enough younger
taxpayers. Something from mine, they're saying, we'll give you more if you get 70. If you wait till 70, I'm like, well, is it even going to be there? That's why some people are thinking.
That's exactly it. And I think one of the most prophetic people on this, actually, was several decades ago when she wrote her fictional work, Children of Men, was P.D. James, the English crime writer who wrote this dystopian novel called Children of Men about a future world where every woman has gone infertile. And they don't know why, but basically the youngest person in the book when the book starts is 18 years of age. And she just charted out, and it's a fictional work, but I think a lot of her predictions have, like, they've come true and they will come true. Like, one of the big aspects of the book is euthanasia is really big. But they call it the quietus. They have a ceremony and it's presented as this thing. But what they're really doing is just getting rid of elderly people because it's cost too much. She also predicts in the book like an immigrant class who will be exploited. So they're brought into the country to do the work that younger people used to do. And then when they're useless, they're disposed of, they're thrown away, they're ditched. And I think you'll see a lot of that. Richer nations will try and attract the remaining immigrants, the high-skilled ones. And then I wouldn't be surprised if Africa has its own MAGA moment where they say, well, let's make Africa great again. And why are we sending all our best and brightest away to these Western countries that didn't have enough kids? We're so minerally rich per square meter. Why don't we? And I think that wouldn't, like, if you talk about, Brendan, could God have a revival in store? Well, imagine in Africa steeped in, like it has been, because the Christian missionaries went there, steeped in Christianity. That then returns the favor to the West by becoming the dominant power. That could be quite a different I mean, that could be a profound moment of already starting to see it in some ways.
It's happened in the past, hasn't it? There have been some countries that have been evangelized that have become great hubs of evangelism in Korea and South America.
Yep. You're seeing it very clearly right now in some Christian denominations. So in my Catholic tradition, what we're seeing, like a lot of Western evangelists, missionaries, nuns, monks, and priests went into from Ireland and places like that, and they took the gospel to Asia and Africa. What we're now seeing is, as the West has sort of declined, we are now seeing a lot more of our ministers coming from Vietnam, from Asia, from Africa, from India. So they're really strong. And the faith that was seeded to them, they're in a phase where it's really strong. And I think probably some of those places have profound persecution too, which helps. And they're now coming back as missionaries back into the West. So we're not the only ones either. That's not an uncommon story amongst Christianity. So.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. You know, we talk about freedom. And do you think that whole concept of individual freedom has really contributed to the decline of the West? In other words, freedom means we can do whatever we want to do. Freedom from all restraint rather than kind of a freedom to, freedom from the good, freedom from doing what we should.
Yeah. Yeah, there's really two problems, I think, at work there. One is that we've lost that Christian concept of what authentic freedom actually is. And authentic freedom in Christianity is not the freedom to do whatever you want. It is the freedom to do what is good, what is true, and what is beautiful. And as you submit yourself more to what is good and true, the more freedom you discover. It's a paradox. Jesus says, if you want to find your life, you've got to lose it. So you don't find it by trying to hold on and grab more of it. You lose it. And in doing so, you find it. And so the Christian concept of freedom was very strong in the West. I can't remember who it was. I'm pretty sure it was one of the founding fathers of America, actually, who said, freedom is only a good horse to get on if you've got somewhere to ride it. In other words, you don't just get on the horse of freedom and go nowhere. And that's what we've done in the West. We've gone nowhere. Yeah, and so we've lost sight of that Christian concept of freedom. And I think also there's a way in which perhaps, the sense of discovering what human flourishing really is all about has been lost too. And but in particular, losing sight of that Christian sense of authentic freedom. And basically it's left people really stumbling around in the dark and also confused about how they might really truly find themselves, how they might flourish as a human person. And I think the other things, the flip side too, is that you don't see this as strongly in England, by the way. England has a sort of its own trajectory with governance and democracy that's slightly different to the American experience and certainly the French one. America is influenced by a bit of both English and French. And the French side is more revolutionary. It's more of the Enlightenment liberal side. But people forget, in actual fact, people like Hamilton, who's pivotal in the founding of America, Jefferson's another one, they are not French-minded. They are more English-minded. They have a more, I think, a more Christian sense of things like freedom, and they are authentically conservative, actually, rather than libertarian. And in England, what you have is their sense of rights and freedoms tends to be framed, certainly philosophically at least, in the negative. So it's the freedom from oppression rather than the freedom to do whatever you want. It's the freedom from someone doing evil to you rather than the freedom just to create whatever you want. You know, it's a negative framing, but I don't mean in a bad way. I mean, you are protected from something rather than you are handed a blank slate to do whatever you want to, the positive framing. And that tends to be the French model. And a lot of people confuse that now. They think, well, just do whatever you want. But in actual fact, freedom that is really a gift that we're given to be free from oppression, in a sense, so that we can actually give of ourselves and discover ourselves more fully.
Yeah, good stuff. Listen, if you kind of were starting to land the plane a bit, but if you had a few minutes to talk to a Western leader, whether that be a president or prime minister or a university chancellor, what do you think you would plead with him about? I mean, to recover before it's too late.
I'd say spiritual revival. And what I mean by that is, I'd say, even if you're not a Christian, like if you're in a university, I would bring in good, solid Christian community into your university community and make it pride of place. When you do, you know, awards ceremonies at the end of the year, people get their doctorates, make sure that you actually have that authentic tradition represented there in a meaningful way. Open the ceremony with prayer. And I get a lot of people might not even be Christian in the room, but what you're doing is you're pointing people towards some fundamental truths. You're pointing them obviously towards the truth of the tradition which founded the West and this very institution you're in. You are pointing them towards the fact that they are not the most important thing in the world. There is a higher power. They should be accountable. There is a moral vision that they should strive to live out, even if imperfectly. So I'd say, and I'd say the same to a national, a country's leader. I'd say, look, you've got to figure out ways to actually give privilege, I mean healthy privilege, to the Christian church in your nation. And so, you know, if you've got rid of parliamentary prayer, for example, bring it back, and it's got to be Christian prayer because that's our tradition. Now, it doesn't mean that we disdain or disrespect others who have walked different journeys, religious journeys. No, but this one is given privilege because it is our tradition and it's so important. And then I'd say you've got to figure out how the Christian church can be empowered by the state. And so the state's not running the church, but the state is saying, well, we'll use our power that we are blessed with to help the church be the best it can, the Christian church in New Zealand, because that will help our nation. And it will help, it'll build good, strong families, and that will mean that we'll have a good, strong nation. And so we've got nothing to lose by doing that.
Yeah. And how can the church practically help the state without, you know, they becoming syncretized, they becoming like it used to be, you know? I mean,
well, here's the funny thing. It never really was. There's a bit of a mythology, and it really does stem, I think, a lot from that Enlightenment period when you have these black myths that are created out of France, really, as the sort of hostile to Christianity. It's Catholicism in particular, but Christianity in general, they're hostile to it. And so they start creating these black myths and, you know, the church ruled the country. It actually didn't. So there's always, the Christian tradition actually always had a healthy understanding. Now, at times there are excesses. We can point to got no problem there. But the theology and the philosophy around that, there was always a recognition there were two separate spheres. There was a secular sphere, not as an atheistic, as an outside of the sphere of the Christian, you know.
Yeah.
And then there's the sacred sphere, the religious sphere. And the two spheres had different, at times there's sort of some overlap, but they're different. But they're different realms of authority and governance. And that's very much grounded in the Christian scriptures. One thing I do practically, in fact, I'm just opening it up now so I can actually recite the thing properly. But I have a little document that's constantly being updated, my morning prayer intentions. And there's all sorts of stuff on there. But at the end of that, every day, every morning, I pray this simple prayer. I think we could all pray. And it comes directly from St. Paul's writings, actually. I pray for our prime minister, our government, and all political leaders. May they govern with wisdom, prudence, and virtue so that we may live religious and reverent lives in peace and quiet. Because that's exactly what it says in the New Testament. We're supposed to pray for that every day. So, you know, that's one practical way. And then I think the church has got to get a bit bolder. So that church leaders have got to speak to our truths and also take those truths into the public square. And where the state is overstepping its bounds, our leaders have got to get a bit stronger at saying, hey, hold on, stay in your lane, political leaders, we'll stay in ours. And I think that there's got to be a bolder proclamation of the goodness, the truth, and the beauty of the Christian vision. Again, that spiritual and metaphysical and anthropological revival and renewal, it's got to come from the church. And that means our leaders need to be boldly proclaiming to the culture, hey, this is who God made us to be. And we'd love you to join us on that beautiful journey and flourish just like we are. You know, I think that's the only way culture will start to shift in a good way.
Do you think they, like the Destiny Church and Brian Tomicki, that they take that too far when they you know, they proclaim boldly what a marriage is and what it's not and those kinds of things? I mean, in one way, I really applaud them, their courage and their tenacity. They sure have taken a lot of flack, a lot of heat, though, and are painted as haters.
Yeah. Well, and I think, interesting enough, what you see with Brian Tomicki and the Destiny Church, in a sense, is there's been a vacuum that has arisen in culture. As a lot of mainline Christian churches have sort of gone quiet, nature wars
the battle.
Yeah, they've stepped in because they see a need. You're not the only one who said to me, you know, you have, in some sense, a sense of admiration. I've had mainline, major, top level Christian leaders say to me quietly. They wouldn't say it publicly, but they say, "Oh, I actually admire that guy. He takes a stand." And so the problem though is that I think there's a bit of a marriage at the moment going on of other political issues that are outside the realm of what a Christian church should be focused on. But you're right, there is. I don't think you need to have the protest version though to have that strong voice. There are lots of ways that can happen, and some ways it is still happening in some areas. But I think we need to recover that deep sense of the metaphysical, what reality is, that needs to be proclaimed boldly, our anthropology, what a person is, and therefore part of that is going to be what a good moral life actually, what the moral ideals should be. Because if you don't have someone proclaiming that, and it's got to be the Christian church, then politicians will just make it up for themselves, and that's what we're seeing right now.
Yeah. What would be your message to, you know, you come across a young adult, lost, confused, whatever, growing up in our post-Christian world or whatever, what message of hope would you give them? What would you tell them not to forget?
Well, I would say you guys right now, unfortunately, have been, in some ways you are blessed. You're living through a period where because of the old order has collapsed, there's a certain freedom to discover the truth. And it's a bit more open now. When you've got guys like Joe Rogan and others expressing some of these ideas or an interest in Christianity, I mean, he started attending a church. He's talking about his problems with abortion. That's a very different cultural climate. There's a lot more free space to explore, which is a gift. I would say in another sense, though, you're also burdened with the generations who came before you have laid an unfair, and in fact, I would say an immoral burden upon your shoulders, because they didn't nurture. They didn't weed the garden. They didn't tend to the tree. And then they've left you in a state of a crisis that you've got to live out. It's all good, for example, to, I mean, I'm married 21 years, going on 22 years married and got kids. And if you're not careful, you can forget that for a lot of young people today, even the concept of marriage is not, that they're sort of uncertain about where they're even going to find someone to marry and what that means. And the culture hasn't prioritized it and celebrated it. And then there's all these people who've benefited from it that have gone before them that are looking down on them going, what's the problem? So that, and another unfair burden, I think, is a great existential crisis, a crisis of meaning. We haven't told them where they can go to seek meaning. We just said, well, make it up for yourself. So I'd say to young people, look, come back to the foundation, come back to the source. It is Christ. It is his body, the Christian church. Paul tells us, you know, it is the bulwark, the defender of truth. So come back to that. Come back to the Christian scriptures. I've encountered so many people lately who told me that they just started reading a Bible and something happened. They started reading a great Christian
Imagine
work.
That.
You know, go and read. If you're not sure where to start, Peter Kreeft and C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis is great. And I'm not talking about Narnia. I'm talking about some of his philosophy. And Peter Kreeft has often been called the modern C.S. Lewis. And that might start you on a journey that will take you in surprising places. But then do the fundamentals well. Live a life of virtue. If everyone else against you is swimming in the wrong direction or their life is a mess, don't just follow along. Live a life of virtue. Commit yourself to that virtue. And get the fundamentals right. You know, live your daily life with a sense of order and structure and orientate it towards the good, the higher good. And obviously God is the ultimate good who we should order ourselves to. But at the very least, if you're not ready for that step, order it towards the love of neighbor at the very least and make that a regular occurrence in your life.
Love it. I love your passion for that. I'm going to ask you one last question, Brendan, that I tend to ask all my guests on the show. And it's this, what waters your soul as a Christian? I mean, some people say their walk with God has become stale or stagnant or whatever. What keeps your spiritual life flourishing and alive most?
Well, it's got to be prayer. For me, and I understand that people say, oh yeah, I went on a, you know, when I was younger, I was full of fervor. It's true, you know. The sin of youth is passion in a sense and excess. There's an Australian Catholic bishop who famously once said, young people, your job is to set the church on fire. Old people, you're there to make sure they don't burn the place down. So the sin of older people, though, I think is pride. We tend to get a bit regimented and we can lose that passion. So for me, I've realized having a stable, solid spiritual life, an interior life orientated around God is essential. And that's got to be a daily commitment. And for me, I'd lapsed into a bit of a routine where I thought, well, I don't need to worry about praying on Sunday because I'm going to church on Sunday and I'll pray with everyone there. And now I've really changed that in recent years where I'm like, no, every morning, every single morning, I've got to start my day with prayer, with some scriptural reading, and also a little bit of reflection on some source of great Christian writing. I'm reading a bit of Augustine at the moment, you know. Uh-huh. And so I think that's essential. And then also trying to read. It doesn't necessarily have to be, like non-fiction, but reading, I think, in your spare time, so much of our spare time is captured now by entertainment and trivial things. Yeah. But I'm thinking even good literature that comes from that Christian tradition that points us to goodness and truth and beauty. And I think that's essential as well. That helps to foster that interior life. But prayer is just essential. It's just a non-negotiable. And as I said, every morning for me, there's scripture, there's prayer. And I think the pinnacle of that is when you start to contemplate God more fully.
Just going to ask that. Is it kind of, you're a contemplative player?
Yeah. So it's, for me, there's a couple of things I do. I heard someone say recently, I think this is a great way of summing it up, the very immature Christian prays constantly for themselves and their own needs. The maturing Christian prays for the needs of others. So I try and do that every day. And mm-hmm. and the adult Christian, the most mature Christian, just contemplates God and gives room for, because what is prayer? You know, when Jesus says, you know, pray, he gives us the Our Father, you know, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. And then, mm-hmm. you know, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So in other words, prayer is about us orientating ourselves to the vision of heaven and then striving to live that out here on earth. And so prayer is not about us trying to get stuff. It's about us being transformed by God. And yeah. so just spending time and giving God that space to speak is essential.
Like, you know, contemplating God, the attributes of God. Can you flesh that out just a little bit?
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of blessed, I think, in a sense, because I come from a tradition where, you know, we don't have too much of a problem with a Christian icon, for example, and just, or an image, and looking at that and yeah. seeing Christ and these deep mm-hmm. theological truths, just being reminded of it. But I think mm-hmm. also just in its most basic form, it is just to, like, for example, to read a piece of scripture and not just to read it, but to stop and to pause and just still yourself and just to contemplate and focus on that, to watch. One thing that I know a lot of Christians, it doesn't matter what denomination, find really helpful is what is sometimes called Lectio Divina prayer. And it's basically you take a passage of the Gospels and you read about an incident in the life of Christ and you just quietly read through it, pause, you go back and you reread it. And this time you think, I'm going to imagine myself being present in that moment. Who am I? Mm. Then you read it. You just read it several times with lots of pauses in between. And you're really giving yourself time to be there and be with Christ in the Gospels and just let him wash over you and speak to you. So I think just giving yourself silence and space to really stop and to just to say, look, I heard it. Here's how I heard it from a wise nun once. she said, look, pray like God is right there beside you because he is. And just tell him honestly what's going on. You don't have to have some great King James language, you know, oh God, yeah. the great yeah. giver of ineffable spheres. No, you just, God, I'm struggling today. And just stop. Lord, I'm experiencing great joy and thank you so much for that. And just stop and allow that quiet and that contemplative to really grow within you.
Yeah. Well, and I think you're blessed with, like you say, within your particular religious denomination, you've got a long history of ascetics, a long history of, you know, priests and people that were in the desert that just knew how to contemplate and sit quiet before God, you know.
And they were some hard doers as well. There were some of those guys and girls, man, I think, oh, my life is tough. And they were just like embracing the cross. And they'd probably say to me, get over yourself. So,
yeah, get a life. I mean, yeah, some really good devotionals have come out of that. But, well, Brendan, thank you for sharing your time, your wisdom, your expertise, your heart with us. Really appreciate that. And where can people find more of your work? You've got a website?
Yeah. So obviously,
Leftfoot Media.
The ministry is at lifenet.org.nz. That's mm-hmm. life and net as in fishing net, N-E-T, lifenet.org.nz. Mm-hmm. And people can find out about the ministry work in particular there. But I also have a Substack and a podcast called The Dispatches. And that's where I engage more on cultural issues. And there's a free-to-air version, and then there's subscriber content as well. And all of that subscriber support helps to fund the ministry as well. And so, you know, you can get access, though, to plenty of free stuff on there as well. So The Dispatches, you find it on Substack or The Dispatches Podcast. .org.nz from memory will take you directly to the content. I'm on Spotify as well and iTunes, so you can search it up there, you'll find it.
Yeah, you're always talking. Hopefully you don't lose your voice, man.
And I've got to avoid that trap of thinking that I'm wiser than I am. You know, you talk too much and you don't stop to contemplate and listen to God enough, and you know, you start talking rubbish. So yeah.
No, fair. Well, thanks again for that. And for those of you out there that are listening and enjoying it, please make sure you subscribe to the Thinking Matters podcast. So we'll keep interviewing interesting people like Brendan and talking about faith and questions that you have. So thanks and tune in next time. God bless.
For more reasons why we believe,
or to support this ministry, go to
thinkingmatters.org.nz.